is it. This is life, the one you get to go and have a ball. This is it. Straight ahead and rest assured, you can't be sure at all.
Our next guest on Downtown is an Emmy Award-winning screenwriter, producer, and showrunner who's lent his talents to shows like Everybody Loves Raymond, Men of a Certain Age, and the terrific reboot of Norman Lear's One Day at a Time. We are pleased to be joined this afternoon by Mike Royce. Mike, thanks so much for being with us. Let's go back to the beginning, if we can. Not the beginning of time, but for you, starting with college. You went to Ithaca College. My first boss in radio went to Ithaca. Before your time, though, he was there when Rod Serling was a professor there and had him for class.
Oh, wow. Yes, Ithaca is, Rod Serling's, probably the most famous graduate Ithaca person that there is. And that's incredible. Yes, we hear tales of him shooting. We used to hear tales of him shooting in the streets of Ithaca or some kind of movie stuff or something. But yeah, Rod Serling, he's a legend.
And so you got out of Ithaca, and the world of stand-up comedy beckoned. What that seems to me like such a frightening thing to do. What made you go in that direction?
Well, it was frightening to me as well. In fact, when I was at Ithaca College, a couple of people that, friends of mine did stand-up there, on the occasional student night where they'd have stand-up or whatever. And that just terrified me because I could not imagine being trapped with my audience for the next however many years I was there after I hopefully did well. But what if I bombed, if I bombed and then I'm walking around campus and every day somebody's like, oh, remember when you sucked, so I just never even flew into my head to do it in college. But then after college, I moved to New York. My roommate from college had gotten an apartment on Staten Island and had an open room. And so I just moved in with him. And then being in New York City, which was a dream of mine, I really took to the anonymity. I realized, I guess in my head, I sort of made the calculation I could go do an open mic. And if I did terribly, I would go home and I would never see any of those people ever again. So that made me brave to try it. And so I did. And, first couple times actually went okay. The third time I got a lottery number at the Improv. So this was when the Improv was the biggest club in New York. And getting a lottery number on their once a month open mic night was it was like winning the lottery. And I had drawn number three, which was a really good spot. So it was like this thing that should have, if I would have been praying for it to happen to me later in my career when I was actually ready. But going on stage for the third time ever was not, that was not a good time to get that number. Because I went on after real comedians who were really good and had a very bad set, 5 minutes of kind of silence. And then I had to take the ride of shame home all the way to Staten Island, subway to the ferry. It was an hour and a half, 2 hours with this terrible feeling in my stomach. And I thought, I don't think I can ever do that again because this feels so bad. And then, a few weeks later, I was like, yeah, let me try it again. So I think that's what you need when you're to be a stand-up is take the punch and then somehow get the urge to do it again.
Well, and when it works, that's got to be a very, very addicting thing to be out there and have the audience in the palm of your hands.
Yes, it's certainly my personality took to it. And, as you evolve as a stand-up, you have to, you have to get used to not taking the highs too seriously or the lows. Mm. You kind of enjoy it, but you have to keep it on a more even keel or else you'll go out of your mind.
Well, you had great success. You worked as a warm-up comedian, number of television shows. How did you end up working together with the Sklar brothers?
Well, they came to New York after I was there and kind of immediately, I was already established as a stand-up, but it was in the middle of the 90s, and, you know, quote-unquote alternative comedy was becoming a bigger and bigger deal, you know, and there were these shows down at Luna Lounge and these very alternative places, as opposed to, like, I was at the Comedy Cellar most of my comedy career, as well as some of the other Gotham Comedy Club and Catch a Rising Star. But these were, you know, conventional stand-up, basically. So these alternative spaces were open to, I mean, that's where Upright Citizens Brigade started really coming up in the world, and a lot of different kinds of comedy that was kind of blossoming. Marc Maron was kind of the king of that little, you know, that atmosphere. And the Sklars really took to, the Sklars were just doing some hilarious stuff that was, you know, they did like a sketch shows. They did kind of a more theatrical things that was like almost like a play. And somehow we hit it off, and they hired me to do more. I was doing warm-up comedy at the time as well for like the Maury Povich show. And, you know, television, you know, very conventional warm-up, I guess you could say. So they hired me to do warm-up for their alternative show, but they wanted me to kind of do like a, almost like a satire of warm-up, you know, like make fun of doing warm-up while I was doing warm-up, which was very appealing to me because I had been doing warm-up for a long time, and there's a lot to make fun of. So they enjoyed that, and then they got this show on MTV and called Apartment 2F, and they hired me to be one of the writers. So that was my very first writing job.
Then you end up, I think in season 4, joining the writing staff for Everybody Loves Raymond. Already a big hit. Was it a challenge for you, though, to go from, as a stand-up, essentially being your own boss, to now having to pitch your ideas in a writer's room setting?
Yes, you have completely identified the hard thing. The most difficult mind adjustment, because stand up, by the time I got on Raymond, which I was, you know, super fortunate to jump on it was the fourth season. They were already a big hit, you know, very rare and, you know, fortunate opportunity for me. I was a pretty successful stand up comic at the time. So you kind of go into a writer's room and you think, well, I know how to get laughs, but that's not what going into a writer's room is all about. So you pitch a lot of ideas, and sometimes people laugh, sometimes people don't, but it's a collaborative process. And a lot of times when you pitch an idea, people kind of think on it. They don't necessarily burst out laughing. In fact, you know, they might laugh at a joke, but they might not laugh at an idea. And it's just a completely different way of working. And you're right. It's like I was very used to, I say something, the audience laughs. I say something, the audience laughs. And this audience of very talented writers, that's not the way it works. So it took really most of the first season for me to feel secure in there. And you know, many of the writers were former stand-ups even, but they were at that moment, they had been writing for a while. So they were used to how things work. And it was an extremely well-run writer's room, you know, Phil Rosenthal being the showrunner and the creative show, and it was a great place to learn. So I was, again, extremely fortunate to just have a place that taught me well.
Was it a different style of writing, because it was such a character-based show, and there were certainly lots of laughs, but not so much jokes as funny situations?
Yeah, it was very instructive to find out that you didn't just go in there and, I guess I thought people would be kind of hurling jokes back and forth and deciding which jokes to put in. And really, it was all about story. They were talking about story and how the characters would feel in the moment. And it was never like, you know, let's just try to figure out some jokes. It was like, how is Deborah feeling right now? And what kind of joke do we need? What, she would say something like this, you know, because she's feeling this way. And so it was very, yes, good lesson on character motivations and writing according to how the characters were behaving and feeling, as opposed to just coming up with funny crap.
We're talking with Mike Royce here on Downtown. What is it about Phil Rosenthal that makes him so good at what he does?
I don't know. I know he is very talented in many ways. You know, he has a food show now called Somebody Feed Phil that is a gigantic hit on Netflix. I mean, he goes into restaurants and people want to take pictures with him. We used to go, the Raymond guys, we all go out to dinner every once in a while. Some of the writers, you know, we've just stayed in touch. And, you know, Ray Romano is very famous and people want to take pictures with him. And over the last couple of years, suddenly Phil Rosenthal, they want to take pictures with Phil. When we're in a restaurant, that's like his, you know, that's his domain. So he's very driven to do things that he, you know, when he sets his mind to doing something, he is extremely good at making that happen. He just has such a love for food and even more so sharing what he knows with people. He just has this, like, that's like his mindset is like, I tasted this amazing thing and you have to experience it too. That's the way that he operates. And that's been true ever since I've known him. When we would sometimes go on trips as the, you know, Raymond cast and crew, and we go to Vegas sometimes because that's what a network hit show let you do back then. And, you know, he'd take us to all these different restaurants. You got to try this. You have to have this. He wants to share it with everybody, you know.
Well, when a show that's that successful and long running comes to an end, obviously it's tough, but is it at the same time, is there a sense of relief that other avenues now are open for you?
Well, for me, it wasn't that I thought the show should keep going, but it was also suddenly I was out of my little bubble of security into the unknown. My wife and I moved to Los Angeles with a 10-month-old baby in 1999 for the Raymond job, and then just stayed on the Raymond train for six glorious seasons. the schedule was predictable. I knew where I was working. It almost felt like, I guess this is what TV writing is. And it was one of the most rare experiences that you can have, to have a, you know, secure situation on a television show. And so when it ended, I was a little confused because I was like, where's this? So where do I sign up for my next hit show? which, you know, didn't really ever happen again the way it happened with Raymond, because that's like a once in a lifetime experience. So it took some getting used to, but, you know, in the meantime, I mean, ever since then, I've had a long and glorious career. It's been, you know, I've just been super fortunate to be able to work with people that I want to work with and do shows that I want to do. So, but there was an adjustment period just of figuring out what the world was.
Well, you end up being hired as showrunner for Lucky Louie. Obviously, the issues there with Louis C.K. have been well documented, but I'm in that camp that thought it was a brilliant show, a bit sometimes challenging show to watch. I had to have to think it was a bit of a challenge, too, to be a showrunner on a show with a guy who also, it's his gig and he knows what direction he wants it to go.
Well, that's right. It was a good first experience. It was sort of a baptism by fire. It was his show, you know, and it was my first showrunning experience. He was pretty experienced in a lot of, he had been a TV writer. He had been in front of the camera. He'd done a lot and he had a super clear vision for how he wanted the show. So, you know, I was there to facilitate what he wanted, which is sometimes what a show running gig is, especially if you have a big star attached or something like that. So it was a good learning experience in that respect. It was, you know, my sensibility is different than Louis. he's pretty singular. And of course, I got to find out sort of what I like and what I don't like. And sometimes I liked what he didn't like and vice versa. But at the same time, when you're working together, you work on what you like together. So it was, I guess, a good first lesson in collaboration.
It brings us to one of my favorite shows. How did you and Ray Romano come up with Men of a Certain Age?
Oh, well, thank you. That was when I was waiting. There was a long period where it looked like Lucky Louie was going to get a second season. It took months and months to find out that that was not going to happen. So during that time, I started getting together with Ray, who, you know, we were friends and had done the show together. And we were kind of like, you know, let's write a movie. Let's try to figure something out. And the movie, the getting together turned into, you know, two middle-aged men, I guess, talking about what kind of crap was going on in their lives. And it was just a very interesting time. We were both experiencing, you know, crisis is not the right word, but midlife feelings. You get to that age and you start to take stock and evaluate, and there's a little bit of a sense of I'm at the sort of at the top of the mountain, and which way am I going to keep going up, or am I now looking down the other side? And those feelings happen to anybody, which was evidenced by them happening to very successful, famous Ray Romano, who was a little bit asking, like, is it all over for me? You know, I did this amazing show. It's never going to get any better than that. He said he played golf for 3 months after it was over. And then it was suddenly like, wait, is this now I just do, like, you get, he said he needed to keep working. He just didn't know what to do next, you know. He wasn't going to spend the rest of his life just kind of like relaxing. So all these feelings became characters. We started talking about friends of ours who were also middle-aged. Basically, all three characters on that show, a married guy, a divorced guy, and a guy who's never been perpetually single, are all pieces and parts of people that we know. And we decided, cable was ascendant a little bit, and streaming had not really started yet, but there was maybe a place for a show like this, even though it wasn't necessarily, you know, like a CBS show. So we started to pursue that.
Well, for me, it was the first time I realized that not every stand-up is a terrific actor, but Ray showed so much depth and the ability to play comedy and drama equally well.
He's so talented, and I feel like I had a secret that nobody else knew when we were doing the pilot, you know. I knew he was such a good actor. All of us on Raymond knew that. But, you know, like when you're doing a sitcom, you do sitcom things. And he was excellent, one of the best to ever do it at that. But it feels like, you know, people, that's all people see when you do that. And it was funny, when we started filming, he's like, you know, what's going to happen is Andre is going to be the funny guy on this show. And, you know, Andre Brower, up till that point, had not done any comedy.
Right.
On film, in film and TV at all. We looked for evidence. We couldn't find any. When we were hiring him, we're like, all right, well, there's, you know, some funny stuff in the show, even though it's a drama, but we'll see what happens. And Ray was exactly right. Ray was sort of praised for the drama stuff, because people hadn't seen that before. And then Andre, you know, suddenly broke out sometimes with some hilarious. Yeah, he's just so talented. And then Scott, you know, Scott just is talented in every way, just perpetually. So he had kind of done both. So it was an interesting mix of people. But
I always say to people, when they talked about Andre Brower in Brooklyn 999, I would say, yeah, it didn't start there, by the way. You got to go back and check out this earlier show and see the first awakening of that, at least for us to see. And Ray has done so much good work. Mark Duplass is a good friend of our show. And I love the two-hander they did a few years ago, Paddleton.
Me too. Yes. Fantastic movie. And, you know, Ray and I don't know Mark, but I know his work. That's a perfect combination of talents right there. Because Ray is, the thing about Ray is that he doesn't play a false moment, you know. He's not the type of actor that you're going to, I don't know, like that's going to disappear into a character where you're like, oh my God, I didn't even know it was him. Mm. You know, you kind of always know it's him. But he has a giant range because he just plays moments truthfully. That's the number one goal as an actor, I think. He just has this basic way of always feeling like he's authentic. He's just got a lot of talent, even though he'll always, he doesn't like praise.
From Men of a Certain Age, you moved on to Enlisted. I didn't know this until recently, that they aired the episodes out of sequence.
Yeah, there were some programming problems for that show. Where Kevin Beagle, my good friend Kevin Beagle, created it, and we ran it together. And I'm trying to compress this story, but basically, it was supposed to premiere in November during a certain year, and then they moved it to January. And in the meantime, Fox had the Super Bowl that year. And they asked us to do a football-themed episode because, according to them, during Super Bowl week, they were going to have all these football-themed episodes by, every show was doing it. And we kind of, okay, so we came up with an episode that would have been the ninth episode. But then they moved us to January, which meant that ninth episode was now going to, since it was football-themed, had to air fourth. And we argued with Fox because now, even though, yes, it was football themed and it matched with the Super Bowl week, it was completely screwed up our storytelling because there's a guy who's like breaking up with a girl who he hasn't even met yet. You know what I mean? So they did not listen and they aired it out of order and it made our fan base. The show started out with a pretty good jolt of ratings, and then a number of things happened where they took away our lead in and they put on repeats ahead of us, and then also this out of order thing that I think kind of screwed with the minds of people who were actually trying to watch the show. It was unfortunate. Luckily, now we live in the streaming world where Enlisted was on Hulu for a while. I think it's not there anymore, but you can buy the DVD, and I think it'll probably be streaming somewhere else at some point. And when it streams, you can, Hulu was very gracious to put them all in the right order. So you can experience it these days the right way.
Mike Royce with us here on Downtown. How did you end up getting together with Gloria Calderon Kellett and the great Norman Lear to develop the Reimagined One Day at a Time?
Well, that was an interesting Hollywood experience because Norman and his producing partner, Brent Miller, met with me and they're like, we want to do this reboot, a Latino reboot of One Day at a Time. Meanwhile, it's, us three non-Latinos talking. And I'm like, it's not going to be just us, right? Because I don't know how to tell that story. I can help tell a story if someone is living that has that authentic life experience. So they were, of course, also meeting with Latino writers, and they picked Gloria and they kind of put us together, and it was a little bit of a shotgun marriage. We met in Norman's office on the first day of, working together. We hadn't met before we worked together. I guess if we had hated each other, we could have gotten out of it. But we had a 2-hour meeting with Norman, and then the two of us went and got coffee, and we talked for another 2 hours about stuff we wanted to do with the show. And we just immediately hit it off. Our creative sensibilities really mixed well. I mean, we just like a lot of the same things. Our storytelling goals are similar. And it was, I've had a lot of great collaborations, and that's just, one of the best. Gloria and I, and we're still, we talk all the time, and we have a pilot actually that's in consideration somewhere. So, can't say too much about it, but hopefully it'll get somewhere.
That's wonderful. Well, you assembled such a phenomenal cast, and it's that rare reboot that was every bit as good and in many ways even better than the original.
Well, thank you. I mean, it was definitely a anxiety-producing situation to be like, so are we going to be the ones who ruin Norman Lear's legacy? Like, he could have got out. He didn't have to come back, And I think we managed to live up to it, at least, we having that as the bar made us work extra hard to do things the way Norman would. And it was Norman became our greatest cheerleader. Like, he was always there. He was at every table read and every taping. And he would talk to the crowd beforehand. And, he wasn't involved in the writing, but it was wonderful to know that he would tell us all the time. He was very supportive, and he would tell us what he liked, and give us just praise us all the time to keep us keep our spirits high. So, you know, that was a good feeling knowing that he liked what we were doing and that it fit into what into his, you know, genre, his body of work.
Well, and he had such a remarkable life and career, and up till 101 years old, never seemed to lose his enthusiasm.
No, no, an incredible, like, just wanted to keep doing stuff. I saw him, you know, and he stayed very with it and smart and sharp. And I saw him do a panel that Judd Apatow. It was the two of them were talking, but Judd was kind of interviewing Norman, and it was in front of at Ted Sarandos's house, I think, if I remember right. So this giant Hollywood, you know, gathering, and Norman is just without notes and just, you know, holding forth with all this wisdom and, I mean, stories, but also just really like well thought out philosophies and, I mean, stuff about show business, stuff about politics, stuff just about life. I was like, I could not speak extemporaneously that well and that, you know, with that much wisdom at any point in my life, much less when I was, I guess he was probably 98 at the time.
Well, so, you had the wonderful run on Netflix and tremendous critical response, and a lot of people were watching as well. But then the Netflix business model seemed to be, if correct me if I'm wrong, more geared toward getting new subscribers than maintaining quality shows. And I remember Stephen Tobolowsky sharing with us your Herculean efforts to go out there and find a new home for the show that eventually led to Pop TV.
Well, that's right. And, you know, all the credit there goes to Sony TV, who were absolutely dogged in trying to find a home. And it was a incredible thing that we got rescued. We got canceled. And then I think we were the first show, and maybe still, I think, one of the only shows to go from streaming to a traditional form of television. So we went from streaming to cable, which I don't even know. There's been a couple, I think, here and there, but so we went to Pop, and it was fantastic for a very short time. And the reason it was only a short time is because the pandemic happened, and we ended up filming 6 episodes. We then turned another episode into an animated episode,
which was great, by the way. I love that.
Thank you. It was quite an experience to go through, and we're very proud of it. And we still have, you know, we have 6 episodes that we didn't get to film, including, of course, the what would have been probably the season finale, maybe the series finale. I don't know if we would have continued to do seasons or whatever. But, you know, we have it actually after now a couple of years have gone by, but we're having a table read this Saturday.
Right, I mean, right.
It's only for people in Los Angeles, of course, unless you want to travel. But yeah, we're going to read some of these episodes. The cast is going to read, including the season finale, at the theater at the Television Academy.
And this will benefit Norman Lear's organization, People for the American Way?
Correct. That's right. That is Norman's organization, and we're doing well. We're almost sold out, but a few tickets left. So we're trying to, I actually just posted a bunch of stuff this morning because we want to sell that puppy out. But we're really excited about it, just to have this sort of, you know, tiny bit of closure to that open-ended season.
That's exciting news. Wonderful indeed. I have to ask you before we let you go, you mentioned to me in an email that your family spent time at York Beach.
Yeah, we would go there every year. That was where we vacationed when I was growing up, in the 70s and the 80s. And I have been back as recently as last year. We took my mom, my brother and sisters took my mom there. So, yes, Maine holds a very, very huge a place in my heart, because that's where I spent some of the best summers of my life.
Well, that is wonderful. Well, Mike, it's great to talk with you. I've enjoyed your work for many years. Look forward to hearing more about the pilot. We wish you luck with that. Hope we can talk with you again when that all comes to fruition.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much for having me. This has been really wonderful.